All right, I'm going to talk a bit about the architecture. This is something that's sort of I've been doing just on my own over the years when I've been writing PHP applications. Never really documented it. When I joined Yahoo a year and a half ago, and my job at Yahoo is basically to convert all of Yahoo over to PHP from their own proprietary scripting languages that they've been using and developing over the years. My big problem was that Yahoo is huge. Well, we have 800, 900 engineers across Yahoo all working on basically web applications. And there are different teams working on each aspect of these various web applications. So I needed to make it nice and modular, and I needed the separation between the back end and the front end stuff had to be very obvious, and also the separation between internationalization stuff and non-internationalization stuff, so that you could take a property, mail.yahoo, for example, designed for the US and launch it in China. So a lot of these things had to be really well organized. So this is basically sort of a stripped down version of the architecture that I came up with for Yahoo. On the front, we have our templates. Everything is template driven. So in our document root, at Yahoo we don't actually use .php, but this is the PHP brand of it. In your document root, have your templates named something, .html, .php, whatever you feel like. These templates should have probably no more than 5% of their content being PHP stuff. Meaning, I don't want to see class definitions. I don't even want to see objects anywhere in these templates. I want to see very, very simple stuff. Maybe an if, maybe a loop, but mostly very simple function calls. Hopefully you don't have any sort of conditionals in there either. Basically you would, and I'll show you an example of what I mean by that, but as simple as you could possibly make this front-end web templating system. The idea is that the back-end logic that you build is going to be the API for this particular application. And you can go to your web development monkeys and say, look, you know HTML, here's a cheat sheet of 30 other things that you can do. Here's how to show the user's name, or here's how to pop up a search box. You might have a PHP function called search box. All they have to do is put this tag in there, in the template, and wherever they put the tag, that's where the search box will be. Or whatever they put login box, that's where that box is going to go. So make it very, very modular so that the UI guys can completely change the look and feel of the application without needing to know anything about PHP. Let them use their normal authoring tools if they prefer using, I don't know, front page, whatever they prefer to use. Let them use those tools. PHP doesn't really interfere with those tools unless you start putting a lot of logic in these front templates. So keep those as simple as possible. Now, in order to get down to that level of simplicity, you're going to need some helper functions. And this second layer is really where things get messy. This is where your HTML and your business logic kind of hit each other head on. This doesn't mean that there's much business logic in here. What it does mean is that there are calls down to the business logic level that's going to return arrays of information from the database, for example. It might return an object that has a bunch of stuff in it. This layer then wraps HTML around that. As simple as you can make the HTML, hopefully use lots of CSS and stuff so that the front end, the UI folks, can just go and edit a CSS file. They can go and edit the HTML file and completely change the look and feel of everything that way. But the idea is here that this middle layer, I keep it in the document root. This says document root star.inc. I changed the extension to differentiate these files that are only helper files. And also I have a rule in my Apache configuration that blocks any direct request for a file.inc. This means that these files can only get loaded up as include files to the main PHP template files. But I keep them in the document root because they contain HTML. And I've sort of made this arbitrary rule that everything that has HTML in it is in my document root or somewhere underneath my document root. It could be in an include directory if you wanted to under the document root, but still, it has HTML, so it lives in the document root. Now, the third layer down is the business logic layer. First of all, it doesn't live anywhere near the document root. It doesn't contain any HTML whatsoever. This is business logic written in PHP. So this would be where you put your MySQL queries, this is where you put your SQL queries, you put your LDAP calls, you put any sort of complex stuff. This is where you would define your classes, and this is where you would do all the really complex things. But again, absolutely no HTML at this level. All this should do is return some simple data structures back to the template helpers, or in certain cases, you could call directly from the template down to this level if the conditions are right. And then the final level is the C or C++ core code. This is sort of where PHP lives. This is all of PHP is here, but you may need to write your own extensions if you have some proprietary libraries that you need to integrate into your application. You would need to write an extension. Or you might find that some of your user space business logic code that you have written at this layer is too slow. And one way of speeding it up would be converting it to C and linking it directly into PHP at this layer. At Yahoo, we have a lot of code at this layer. We have 120 PHP extensions now that are Yahoo specific that do all kinds of interesting things. So the busier your site and the more scalable you need it to go, the more you have to push down into native code. And that's just a factor of the fact that we get hit more than any website in the world out there. And every little millisecond counts in response time. So an example of this architecture. This is a really stupid example. It doesn't do very much. But first of all, I have configured my PHP ini file to auto-prepend my helpers file. So this, my helpers.inc, remember that was my second layer down, that cleans up my template a little bit. Because that means there's not even an include in my template. So this is my top-level template. The next layer down has already been automatically included because I did my auto-prepend file. So every request is automatically going to run helpers.inc first that defines a bunch of functions. Then I have a title. Let's say title, example page, greeting, footer, and in between I just have a bunch of HTML. The idea here is that the web developer can move around the greeting, can change the title, and there's nothing else. This is seriously the only content in this thing. So at the helpers level, the one that automatically gets included, the first thing we do is we include the third layer down, which is the business logic, so that we will have access to those functions. Then we spit out some common things that every HTML page needs to have. We spit out the XML type saying we have a UTF-8 XHTML document coming. Spit out our doc type. Fetch the user record. So here we have some kind of user ID and a cookie, and I then call a get user record, passing in the user ID. Define the greeting function. Remember we had three calls from the template. We had title, greeting, and footer. So I'm defining greeting first here. Greeting goes through and says, hi, user first name. Congratulations, today is your 19th birthday, basically is what it's going to do. In order to put the suffix on the 19 to get the TH on 19th, I have this birthday function. This is the heavy-duty business logic of my little silly application. It goes and figures out if it's this user's birthday. If it is this user's birthday, it will return the string 19th, basically. Otherwise, it will return false. Then I have my title function, and I have my footer function that just spits out standard headers for title and footer stuff. Okay, so that's the template helper layer. At the business logic layer, we had two functions. Remember, we had get user record, because at our helpers level, we just found the user ID via the cookie, passed it down to the get user record function. And these two functions, there's absolutely no HTML here. They just do the heavy lifting. This one does the database connection to fetch the record for this particular user and returns it back to the second layer as an array. The birthday function takes a user ID. Sorry, it takes a user array. Basically, this array gets passed into the birthday function because we need the birthday for this particular user. We could just pass in the birthday. That would probably have been cleaner to pass in the birthday. But I pass in the whole array, and I pick out the birthday element from that array. I check if it's this person's birthday, so I match the month and the day. If the current month and the day matches the month and the day, then it's this person's birthday. I do a little bit of math to figure out which suffix to add. So if it's 1 year old, it's first birthday, second, third. If they're over 100, it still works because I do a modulus 100 here. So it should work for anything. 31st, for example, it'll figure it out. It'll get the right thing. So that's the business logic, end of that. So those are my three layers. The template, the middle layer that wraps a little bit of HTML, break tags and stuff, heads and title, things like that, wraps the actual data coming from our application with HTML, but very simple HTML, and then the top layer that presents this information in the right places. Now the fourth layer down, we wouldn't necessarily need a fourth layer here, but say we had a page that listed 500 people and their birthdays, and we had to call this birthday function 500 times on every request. Then it might become worthwhile to convert it to C. Still probably not, but imagine this function was more CPU intensive. We can convert it to C. I'm not going to talk too much about building PHP extensions today. There's a tool that comes with PHP called ext_scale. That's ext_scale. It's in the ext directory if you download the PHP source tarball, and that generates a skeleton extension. You basically just have to go through and fill in the blanks. Fill in the config m4 file if you have dependencies on libraries and stuff. And it does most of the hard work involved in building a PHP extension. So you'd run ext_scale, probably call it birthday or something, and then you'd put this function in there. And it looks a little bit complex, but you can sort of go back and compare it to the PHP version, and the logic is identical. Yeah, the syntax is slightly different because it's in C. You get time differently in C. You call local time, for example. We have a PHP local time R, which is a thread-safe version. Other than that, there's a bit of parameter parsing. We have this thing called zenparse parameters that can take a string that defines what parameters you are getting. So if this function took two strings in an array, you would see SSA here. In this case, this thing just takes a single long. So maybe it just... Okay, this version I'm just passing in the birthday directly. So this just takes a single long, which is the Unix timestamp for the person's birthday, and I go and I modify that, and I do the same logic and I return the same string, basically. So those are the four layers that are possible, and if you design your application, there's no way you can ever sort of completely meet this model, but if you try for the most part to meet this sort of model, then you should have a very maintainable, very scalable, very manageable application coming out of it. Every now and then you have to cheat, because sometimes whenever you introduce any sort of framework or rule set like this, sometimes the rules get in the way. And doing it right sometimes means that you have to do either a whole lot more work or that it's a lot slower. And yeah, it's important to do things right, but sometimes you just don't have that luxury. Sometimes when you're getting hit 10,000 times a second, going through the right way of doing it as opposed to going directly to something, sometimes you do have to make that shortcut, and PHP allows you to do that. And if you use this sort of templating system, where we use PHP itself as the templating system, then you can escape. You're not completely restricted from hacking it a little bit when you need to. Other ones that get layered on top, they simply don't let you escape out of the templating mechanism, and that can be catastrophic sometimes. Sometimes you have to go back and then hack your templating system so that you can do this one-off exception that you just desperately need to do. All right, enough on architecture. Let's talk a little bit about security. We have something called safe mode in PHP. It's not really a mode, It's not very safe, but otherwise it's nicely named. What it basically does is it pretends that your script is running as the user that owns that script. Even though your Apache server with PHP linked in might be running as user www or whatever, the scripts that are sitting in the various document root directories are going to be owned by whoever created the file, assuming people aren't editing files as the web server user ID. So I've edited a file called script.php. It's owned by user Rasmus. Now, if I write a script that then tries to do a read file on etc password, at the Unix permissions level, I have read access to etc password, because you sort of have to. That doesn't mean I want my web server and kids writing scripts on my web server to be able to serve up my etc password file via PHP. So this is one of the things safe mode does. If you turn on safe mode, any file access from within PHP will do this check. It'll see who owns the current script that we're parsing, and when then that script does a file access, we check to see, is the file they're trying to access that person's file? Do the owners match? If they don't match, we throw an error. And you'll see an error that says something like safe mode restriction in effect. The script whose user ID is blah, blah, blah cannot access the file owned by UID 0. So this is one of the things that you can restrict by turning on safe mode. This isn't completely foolproof, obviously. Layering a security system on top of the Unix level security system is really stupid. There's no real better way of doing it, though, unless you go with my proxy cache idea of having multiple instances of Apache, where each Apache runs at that as that user's user ID. It's not super safe either, in the sense that third-party libraries that don't know about this extra layer that we've added, if those libraries access files directly, then we can't stop them. For example, in Oracle, in the Oracle client library, there is a way to issue an SQL query that's going to load in a file from disk into Oracle. We can't really detect that. We can't start parsing Oracle queries to see if they've loaded the file. If they load the etc password into Oracle, and then from Oracle they fetch it into PHP, and then they display it, we can't stop them from doing that. Right, so that's what I mean by safe mode isn't very safe. It'll deter the junior script kiddie out there, sure. They'll try it. Damn it, can't access etc password. Oh well, hack another server that's easier to hack, right? So, another thing that safe mode gives, well, it's actually a separate mode. It's called open basedir. You can turn on open basedir and you can set it to a certain document root. That basically means that any scripts that are served up out of this document root are restricted to only opening and accessing files underneath that document root. So if you have somebody in doc root Joe and somebody else in doc root Bob, and they can only edit files in there, they cannot write PHP code that's going to go up in somebody else's directory and read their stuff. They can only access files underneath their current directory. That tends to help some ISPs as well, turning that on. Well, not really, in the sense that you can define, sorry, I should have explained it a little bit more. You can define directories that, open basedir is not just one directory, sorry. I mean, you can define multiple directories that you're allowed to access files from. So you can have a common directory that everyone's allowed to access files in this particular directory. At the Unix permissions level, you can make sure they can't write through it, right? You can make it a read-only directory, put all the common code in that directory, put a colon-separated list in the open basedir, so that you put, for that particular directory, you do the public directory, you do their directory, in their particular virtual host configuration, And then they can still use that model and they can still do this stuff. Yeah, it's not a change root, no. And that's another way of doing it. If you try to use something like SQL and FreeBSD or something and do things that way, it tends to get messy. The safest way is to not share your server with anybody, but obviously if you're an ISP, that's not really the solution. Yeah. Yeah, but SQExec only works in CGI scripts. When you're using PHP as a module inside Apache, then you cannot use SQExec. What SQExec does is basically it switches the user ID, does the fork in exec as that user, and then that process dies and off you go. And in that sense, yeah. I didn't hear all of that, but apparently SSA Linux has some mechanism for addressing this. I'll be interested in reading about that. But. But how would it know what PHP is accessing versus what Apache is accessing? Because sometimes it's the same file. Okay, so it's at the shared library level that they can give permissions to a certain shared library to only do certain things. But I mean, PHP will invoke the Apache functions to do some of its stuff as well. And then you're sort of in trouble. But I mean, that's an interesting idea, assigning permissions to at the shared library level instead. Yeah. Yes, in a certain sense, but still a script running on the server is going to have read access to everything in the web server has read access to. Also, the web server will be able to serve up those files on user Bob, right? And if user Joe looks just like the web server, he can read that data, and that's the big problem. Yeah, that's almost a proxy. Yeah, that's the proxy solution. Yeah. All right. So, now going beyond safety mode and stuff, that's sort of configuration things you can do. At your application level, guarding against outside attacks is really a common sense sort of thing. Uninitialized variables. This is one of the things that prompted turning off register globals. I've always liked register globals. It makes it very, very easy to teach someone PHP when form variables automatically turn into global variables right in your script. You don't have to sort of figure out where they came from and stuff. But yes, agreed, it leads to some variable injection, but it really only affects your code if your code sucks. So if you have logic like this, if user equals Rasmus, OK equals true. If OK, user logged in. Now, I mean, on first glance, you say you can only see user logged in if this condition was true. But you didn't initialize your flag in this script. So someone can inject OK equals 1 right in the URL, for example, which will then, doesn't matter what this condition is, it's automatically going to end up going in here. If you simply have OK equals false at the top of the script, then your script assignment is going to override anything that gets injected into this application, and you're not going to be vulnerable to that particular attack. And you can turn on warnings. If you set your warning level in your PHP INI file to e-all, you will actually get a warning on this script saying undefined variable OK. So it's catching the fact that you're accessing it here without having defined it. And most of the security stuff boils down so that you can't trust user data. don't write code that just says read file name. And so people say, okay, well, let's just turn off regex for globals. But then what you're going to do is you're going to change your code to this, and it doesn't help you, right? Yes, you're going to access your data directly from the post variables, but you're still letting the user determine exactly which file should be read. I've seen lots of code that also puts up like a radio button type form where they have, you can pick one of these three files, and then they send the file name, and then you open up that file directly. People thinking, well, how could they open up another file because there's only three options in this form, right? But anybody can take a form, save it on their own machine, edit it, and post it back to your server with a completely different file name. You have to either sign and encrypt the form, or you have to do some input validation checking on this stuff. And it's not that hard to do. I mean, I'm always hacking forms like this because I was born in Greenland. Most forms don't have Greenland on them. So often I have to hack these stupid forms and add my birthplace to it and then resubmit it, right? And yeah, people have gotten a little bit confused. You know, Greenland, that wasn't one of the options. How did that get in my database? So I've screwed up a few databases that way. So some simple file name validation. Pick out your document root. Get the real path. Real path will resolve stuff like ../..././.... etc password to just etc password. So the real path that some convoluted path actually points to, it'll resolve that. So if you get that simple resolved real path, you prepend the document root to it. That means if they did try to somehow get to etc password, in the end all they can get to is //etc/password. And if it's under your doc root, they could probably get to that directly anyway if it's there, so there's absolutely no hack left. Or check out, strip out extensions, or check the extension that they're asking for. If you only want them to be specifying a JPEG somewhere, then check that the damn thing is a JPEG that's coming in. Even if your form only has a choice of three JPEGs, you still have to do some data validation on this stuff. Don't do a system call like this. System ls$dir might look like they can only list the directory of their choosing, but they could put in something like ../cat etc password, right? And it's going to happily go ahead and list the current directory, then it's going to show them the etc password if you do something silly like this. You basically should never do any sort of system calls with any kind of user data. But if you have to, there's an escape shell arg function in PHP that can go through and make sure that an argument to a shell command is just a single argument. It basically just quotes the thing and escapes stuff so that you cannot escape out and do chain multiple commands together. This is an interesting one. I've started using this .inc syntax a long time ago. And I've seen a lot of security talks and even sections in books where they say this is very insecure because any direct access to this file.inc, since .inc is not registered as a PHP type normally, will show the code for functions.inc in plain text. Basically, anyone who can then go to webserver.com/functions.inc will see your PHP code that's in this file. Now, what people tend to suggest is never use .inc, or if you're going to use .inc, make it a PHP type. So when people access it, they can't see the raw code. They're going to get it executed instead, and they only see the result of that include file. To me, that's extremely bad advice, because this is code that was obviously written to be included. And it has this little indicator here saying this is a file that's supposed to be included in some other grander scheme. Executing code out of context can cause all sorts of wacky problems. So I would rather have them see my code versus having them execute my arbitrary code like that out of context. But what I actually do is I block direct access, like I mentioned earlier. I have this rule in my Apache configuration. Deny all access to .inc files. So they can only be included, and I can keep these things next to each other. And the other thing people generally say is don't put your include files in your document root. which isn't bad advice. It's probably a good idea to not put those on the document root. But I tend to like having this stuff together, all my HTML in one place, so I can grab just one directory and I can do my whole UI definition in a single directory. And this is how I do it, and it is pretty much secure. File uploads, be careful. Be very careful where you put these files that people upload if you turn on file uploads. Yeah, question please. All my examples here in the presentation use that function to actually highlight my source code. So sure. Yeah, but we're talking about hiding stuff, not right. That's sort of the opposite. Yeah, we have a cool function to show code as well, but that wouldn't be very secure if you don't want people to see your code. All right. So file uploads. Be very, very careful with file uploads. Make sure that you check the file and make sure that you figure out where it's going to go. Apache.org got hacked a couple of years ago because someone decided it was a good idea to turn on anonymous FTP uploads and make a writable directory for anonymous FTP users so people could upload patches to an FTP server. That in itself is okay, other than wares and other crap ending up in the FTP directory. Okay, it's not a direct security problem. Someone else said, hey, it'd be cool if we could see what people uploaded from our web server, right? So they made a symbolic link from the document root to this directory, turned on follow some links, so now you can then browse your way to this upload directory. PHP was enabled on this server, so anybody could upload a PHP script via FTP, browse to it to execute it. Then they found some kind of bug in Bugzilla, and via Bugzilla, they managed to get root. Because at that point, once they can upload any arbitrary code, they could run any shell command they wanted as the web user via PHP and FTP. And by that, they eventually found the root exploit in Bugzilla and got root on the server and put up some stupid Microsoft message or something on Apache.org. And somehow, someone designated me as the scapegoat because it was hacked via PHP was the determination. Not that I had anything to do with turning on FTP or making FTP browsable. So the point here is that be careful when you allow anybody to upload anything to your server. Be very, very careful what's uploaded and where you put it. If you are going to let people upload pictures, for example, make sure things are pictures and not scripts. And perhaps go beyond just checking the file type. We have a thing called get image size that actually looks at the content of an image to get the size and the type out of it. So it looks at the byte stream. So if they upload something called .gif, but we look at it and say it's actually a JPEG, we can determine that. IE is also notoriously bad at understanding MIME types. It will look at the content of the file. So people can upload a .gif file that's actually a Microsoft executable, and someone can just, with IE, click on a GIF file, and it's going to execute the program on it. They'll have to click OK to that and stuff, but still, you can really trick IE into doing some really nasty things if the content of the files don't match the MIME types and the file extensions, and it's pretty much random, depending on what version of IE, what happens in that case. So make sure that stuff on there is what you think it is. And check everything. All right. Enough boring security stuff. PHP 5. PHP 5 is an evolutionary change from PHP 4. It's not revolutionary. All your PHP 4 code will pretty much work, with a couple of small exceptions. The biggest of these small exceptions is up first. Objects in PHP 5 are by default references. Meaning, when you try to do something like this in PHP 4, I have a class called OS. It has a property called name and a constructor that just sets the name property. So you knew the class, You get an object back called $Linux, and name is set to Linux from the, via the constructor, right? If I then have a function that changes that particular property in an object, I have to pass in the object. Well, first of all, let's say I want two objects. I wanted a Linux object and a Windows object. In PHP 4, I can simply do $win equals $Linux. This will make a copy of that Linux object. So I now have two copies of the object. To change the second one so that the property now says Windows, I pass in the Windows copy into my change name function as a reference in this case, and I indicate here that it's a reference because I want to change the object itself. I don't want to change a copy of the object. I set this to Windows, and when I then run this bit of code where I echo out the two things, echo Linux name and win name, I get Linux and Windows. That's how it currently works in PHP 4. It's a little bit confusing to people who are used to doing object-oriented code in other languages. This in other languages wouldn't be a copy in itself, right? These two objects would just be two names for the same thing. This is actually consistent with how everything else in PHP works, is that when you do this, you make a copy. If you wanted a reference to it, you would put a little reference indicator in front of it, and you would get a reference to that object, and you make two names for the same thing. But it, for object orientation stuff, it does cause a lot of problems. So we have sort of given up due to peer pressure and then public pressure and said, okay, we will make some references by default. So now in PHP 5, when you do this, if you wanted to do the same thing, you actually wanted two objects, we have this clone mechanism that you would now have to do. So by default, $Linux equals new OS Linux. This hasn't changed. You can still do the constructors this way. What happens now is you get a reference back. If you say $win equals $Linux, then it's just going to be another name for that same reference. If you actually do want to get a copy of that object, you call the clone method. And there is always a clone method. It's built into all objects in PHP 5. When you do a change name, since win is already a reference, we don't have to have the reference indicator here. It's already a reference that's being passed in, so you can just set the property. When you then echo it out, it's going to say Linux Windows again. So that's the big change. If your PHP 4 code is relying on objects being copied around and not being references to each other, then yes, your PHP 4 code will break. 99% of all the code out there that passes objects around, people don't even know that they're passing a copy. Mostly they get an object, they pass it into some function that tends to only do read stuff on it. And that stuff won't change. It doesn't matter if it was a copy. If you're doing read-only stuff in a function on an object, it doesn't matter whether it's a copy or if it's a reference, because it's read-only, it's the same data. If you're writing to these objects, once you're passing them somewhere, then yes, your stuff could break moving to PHP 5. That's the major change. Yes? No. This is only applicable to objects. We've also gained constructors and destructors. We never had destructors before, so that's a new thing in PHP 5. Constructors we've always had, but they were always... You always had to name it the same as the class. So if your class was called OS, if you had a method named OS, that would become your constructor. This turned out to be a little bit inflexible in the sense that you don't, if you want to sort of manually call the constructor for an object, you have to know what class, what the name of the class of that object was to call the constructor. This way, with this calling convention, you can then define a construct mechanism this way, and that's always going to be the name of the constructor for this particular object. It makes it a little bit cleaner. And now we also have a destructor. So if you do this, Linux equals new OS Linux, it's going to automatically call the constructor, so you'll see begin. And as soon as you then dereference that object, as in you reassign $Linux, or you do an unset on $Linux, then the destructor is going to get called. So you would see begin, then done, when this piece of code runs. We've also added PPP. to the optics model in PHP 5. PPP means private, protected, and public. Public we've always had. Everything was always public in PHP, right? So we've really only added two things. We've added private and protected. Private is sort of the strictest of the three. Private means that only the same object can access the property. So in this case, if I try to access this bedroom object from outside of itself, or I try to access the action property of the bedroom object from outside of the object itself, I'm going to get it denied here because this property is labeled private. Private means that only methods in the actual class itself can access it. So if I wanted to somehow modify action, I would have to call some sort of access function in it. You could use, and I'll talk about the getSet stuff in a little bit, you use the getSet stuff, or you could write your own setAction type of method that would then go and set the value of the action property. Protected. That's almost the same as private, but it means here it means that you can also access the property from an inherited class. So you can extend the class and you can access the property from the inherited class. Other than that, it's pretty much the same. Again, you cannot access the property from outside of the classes. The set get that I hinted at, this is basically sort of generic object overloading, both property and method overloading, in the sense that if you define a set method in an object and you call the object and access any sort of property, if that property doesn't exist, it's going to call the set method on an assignment. If you're reading it, it's obviously going to call the get method. That means you get this in, you get dollar name and you get dollar value. You can then, when you set a property on this OS's object, the set method is going to get called and you're going to get Linux as the name and you're going to get rocks as dollar value. You can then determine what you want to do with this. You can add it to an array or you can add it to a database, whatever. So here we've set two things. I've gone through and you'll see there are no properties named Linux and Windows. These are sort of dynamic properties handled via the set mechanism here. If I then var dump the contents via get names, I see I have Linux rocks. Because I filtered out the other ones here. So my set method only let the Linux ones through. It didn't let Windows or DOS through. Right, so it's a way of putting some logic in and accessing that logic on a set or a get of a property. You would only need one double underscore get function because you get the name of the member. Yes. My example just doesn't have a get, but yes. You would then, you could also define your own get function, just like you can define a set function. The get doesn't get the value, obviously, it just gets the dollar name. Otherwise, it's exactly the same. So, just like get and set for properties, we also have double underscore call, which is the same thing for methods. So in this case, my class just has a single method defined. This is the special double underscore call. It gets the name and the arguments, which is an array of arguments to that function. And I can then do hello, uppercase first character, dollar name. So in this case, new hello, call the Rusty method and call the Anton method. The Anton method, right? And it's going to print out hello Rusty, hello Anton. So those methods don't exist because they don't exist, and there's a call method in here. The call method gets executed, and we see the name of the actual call here. There happen to be no arguments here, but the arguments would have been in this array if there were some. Okay. Exceptions. Finally. Sure. All right. Yeah. You can override, they will get, yes. The question is, if you extend an object, what happens? Basically, the get and the set and the call will be inherited, but you can also override it in the child if you feel like it. You can call directly. You can do static method calls. So you can do double colon get if you want that particular class, this version of the get. That starts to get ugly, though. I mean, yeah, you can do it, but don't. All right, exceptions. Exceptions are handy in cases where you have a lot of different operations that all have to work before you can do a certain thing. So in order to insert or select something from a database, you have to connect to the database. You have to select the database you want to work on. Once those two things go through, then you can go ahead and call select. Now, in PHP 4, you sort of have to check to see if each one of them succeeded along the way and put some error checking on each call. In PHP 5, you can throw a try catch around it. Say try doing this, so connect, select, query, and the catch will then catch if any one of these errors out. You have this exception object, and there is a exception object in PHP 5 that you can extend if you want to do your own thing. By default, it just sort of like the default error handler in PHP spits out a normal error message, but you can extend it and override things in that default error handler class to do your own thing on the catch. So actually a pretty simple implementation. But we had a lot of fights and arguments over this one. This isn't really new to PHP 5. It's sort of being refined, and it's really cool in PHP 5, but most of the streams and filtering stuff is actually in PHP 4.3 as well. The user API to it is not really there in PHP 4, but at the C level it's there, and you're using streams all the time. Whenever you access a file, it's actually going through the stream interface and stuff. What streams and filters are? Basically, we have wrappers around streams in the sense that we apply some context to data flowing. So we have a file wrapper, for example. That's just for accessing the file directly. We have an HTTP wrapper so that you can put, you've always been able to do this, but read file HTTP, so you can basically read the file remotely, or you can do fopen, put a URL in there, and it's going to open it up. But that's because we have this stream and a wrapper around it that understands the HTTP URL. You can also do it via FTP, and you can also use this compressed clib that you put in, and it can then read and write compressed files directly via these wrappers. Now, filters are things that can manipulate the data that's flowing through these wrappers. So if you want to remotely read a file and rot 13 all the contents, you can call this string rot 13 filter. And you can define your own filter. You can make user-defined filters, both from the C API and also from the PHP API. So some examples of doing weird things. So we have a PHP filter, string to upper, resource equals that. So basically it's going to go and fetch example.com, pass it through the string to upper filter, and uppercase everything in that particular file, and then print the result. Here we are opening up via the compress zlib filter. We're opening up a local file foo.-bar.txt.gz in write mode, so we're then writing directly into a compressed file. Here we're doing the HTTPS wrapper, so over SSL we're opening up a file. We can also apply the SSL wrapper directly to an FSOC open, so you can directly connect to a socket via SSL. From PHP and specify the port and where the errors should go and stuff, and the timeouts at the end here. You can also do a stream copy to stream, which is kind of interesting. So you can fopen up a URL in read mode, and then you can say open up a file. So you open up two files. First one, k.txt in write mode, open up a second file, remainder.txt in write mode. Then you can do stream copy to stream from the source, which is our open URL, destination 1, which was our open first file, 1024. I mean, it's copied the first 1024 bytes that comes down from this particular URL into this file. And if you don't put a length in here, it'll just mean copy until the end to EOF. Right? So stream copy to stream, the rest of the file is going to end up in that second file. Doesn't seem very interesting, but it can actually solve a lot of copying around of data if you directly sort of direct pieces of files to where they need to go, as opposed to reading the whole thing in and then starting to chop it up. This way you don't have to have the whole thing in memory. You can just stream it directly from one place to another. Another new thing in PHP 5, I've always liked awk. I don't know why, maybe I'm weird, but I sort of like the idea of you run some code at the beginning, then you have another piece of code that runs on a per line basis, and then you have some concluding code that runs at the end. If you don't know awk, well, you don't know what I'm talking about. But basically, this mode here for the command line version of PHP can let you do the same thing. We have a minus B, minus R, and minus E, so begin, end, and this is the runtime stuff, that runs for every line of input. And here you can define a bit of PHP that's run at the beginning, a bit of PHP that runs for every line, and then stuff that runs at the end. So here we just go through and we count. We open up each file that comes from find. So find is going to give us a long list of files. Each line is a file name. So each file name we open up, file reads a file into an array, counts the number of entries in that array, and file automatically puts one line per entry. So here's a very inefficient way of doing sort of a line count of all the files underneath a certain directory. I did this in, I think, one of the PHP subdirectories, 102,000 lines of code apparently in that directory. I think it's cool. I know everyone is going, so what? You'd never use it, right? Hey, it's there. Okay, some more useful stuff. The DOM XML extension has gotten a lot of improvement to it. Here's an example. Opening up a book XML, get the child nodes from doc, get the child nodes of the root, loop through the books. If you know DOM XML, this makes sense. And it's just a cleaned up version of the DOM XML extension. So we had some memory problems, we had some crash problems. DOM XML has sort of been an ugly child for a while, but it's nice now. It's grown up a bit and it's matured. And if you need to do fancy XML handling, this is probably a good way to go now. What we have done, however, we've also looked at XML in general and tried to sort of apply the PHP approach to XML parsing. Say we have this book XML file. So we have books. We have a book object here with title and author properties for each book object. And the books file has a bunch of book objects in it. Now, we have this function called simple XML load file. Pass it book.xml. We automatically turn these things into objects in PHP. So you have a books object, right? The books object has a child book object. So we have this nested structure, object-oriented structure that automatically gets created in PHP. So to access any of these things, you can then loop through books as book, and each book is then going to have book title and book author properties, just like that, because these things get converted directly. You can also create an object like that in memory and do a simple XML write file, and it's going to create the XML directly from that object hierarchy that you have created in memory. So it's a very fast way of also saving an object to a file. We sort of had that before in various functions where you can use to dump things out in a certain format. But here it saves to a very nice generic XML format. It can be read back in. And you can take any XML format and do it really, really easily. RDF, for example. There are all kinds of classes out there to handle RDF. RDF is simple. Load it in, echo out the title if you want to, because you get RDF channel title gives you the title of this particular feed. And then you can loop through each item. So for each RDF channel item as item, each item in RDF has a link and it has a title. Basically, this is a syndication, an XML syndication format that most news sites use, and Slashdot and others. You can always get an RDF feed from these things. Blog sites all have these things. And this is all the PHP code you need to parse RDF in this new simple XML thing. So it's basically part of the language at this point. There's nothing to it. You don't have to write all sorts of code to trigger on various elements and stuff. You just load it in and access it directly. It does have some limitations. You can't do a partial load. So if you have a 10 gig XML file, it's going to want to load the entire thing into memory. You can't say, just load the first 10 objects, right? If you need to do stuff like that, yeah, drop to DOM XML or one of the other ones where you can actually do a partial load like that. But for simple stuff, and most of the stuff that you run across in doing web stuff, it is simple. You really don't need to load a 10 gig XML file very often. Another thing that has taken the problem and made it ridiculously simple is we're bundling SQLite now. SQLite is a SQL interface for flat files. Flat file handling has always been a pain. I can't count how many times people have said, well, my application is really simple. I'm just going to use a flat file. I don't want to bother with a database. Flat file handling in a web environment where you have concurrent accesses to it can get really damn complex. There's no such thing as just using a flat file. If you're going to write these files, unless you're only appending, because appends tends to be atomic, if you're actually writing to the start of a file and having like records in your file, forget it. You'll never get it right. You're not going to get the locking right. You're going to get file corruption. You might as well use a database to begin with. And people say, well, I can't use the database because my ISP doesn't have a database, or I have to pay $5 extra a month to get MySQL set up for me, or whatever, right? With SQLite, there's no server needed. All the functionality of the SQL parsing and putting this information somewhere in a flat file is all done internally by SQLite itself, which is part of PHP now. So, for example, I have this little remove the file right here. It doesn't really need to be there, but it's for my presentation so that I have a new file every time I show this slide. Because these scripts are running in real time. As I'm showing each one, this PHP script that runs, it actually creates the file and does everything you see here. So SQLite open, some temporary file somewhere, set file permissions, give it a variable that it can put the errors into if you need to. If that succeeded, create a table. And it actually has a very complete ANSI SQL syntax. Almost anything you can imagine doing in SQL, it supports, including subselects and all kinds of stuff. It's actually a really powerful SQL engine that just happens to sit on top of simple flat files. Handles all your locking for you, handles everything. It handles it by sort of just locking everything. It's table-level locking. No row-level locking here, right? So if you have a lot of writes by a lot of concurrent clients to the same table, okay, yeah, you're screwed. You shouldn't be using SQLite. But this is as a replacement for flat file manipulation, where you are, otherwise you would have locked the entire file, right? This is a much more flexible approach, and it's also easier if at some point your application outgrows this flat file philosophy and say, okay, damn it, now I need a database. It's very easy to take SQLite and then toss a real database in behind it because you already have the SQL syntax in your application. It's just changing the back end, basically. And I've seen quite a lot of code out there not use the database because they want to make sure that their code works everywhere. Gallery is a perfect example of that. The authors of Gallery decided not to use the database back end to manage all the pictures because not everyone had a database installed, and they wanted Gallery to sort of go everywhere. So they only used flat file manipulation stuff. And the code is a mess. It's unmaintainable. They have this private file format that's horrible. And it's impossible to edit this thing directly because it's their own file format. You have to go through their code. With SQLite, if they had used something like SQLite, then you could use other tools to manipulate that database, copy it back and forth, and do other things with it. So I'm hoping this becomes the standard flat file format for anyone who doesn't want to use a database for storing stuff. SQLite is the way to go. Yes. No, there is an SQLite library, but we're bundling it with PHP 5. It's going to be enabled by default. It's part of the PHP 5 source tarball. Every PHP installation you'll see will have SQLite support. No, it came from somewhere else. I forget the name of the author. It is an external project, right? Anybody can download SQLite and add it to their application. We have just decided that we're going to add it to PHP. It's going to be sort of a basic feature of PHP to have this in there. But yeah, do a search for SQLite. You'll find it. It's actually getting pretty popular in other places as well. And it's really not a replacement for a full database engine. You have to think of it as a replacement for doing your own flat file manipulation. It just blocks it. Straight file locking. Nothing fancy. That's why you don't get row-level locking. You just, each table is a file, right? So it locks the file. But it does it for you. It tends to be when people start locking files on their PHP code, they tend to get it wrong. This has been tested, and this is someone else has written the locking, and it works. Okay, there's also an object-oriented interface, a little bit small, I know. And it has this nifty feature of a memory database as well. So if you sort of need a temporary database in memory to do some stuff, to do some selects on, to do some, I don't know why you might want to do it, but if for some reason you want to do it, it could even be a shared memory database. So you never actually touch the disk, and you can do SQL queries against memory. I find that pretty cool. You can create tables, insert values into them and stuff. And I think it's nifty. All right. As promised, we'll talk a bit about opcode caches. This is standard PHP. This is how it works. Script starts up. We convert the script. HTML and PHP tags get converted into a set of opcodes. A big block of HTML is just basically a straight HTML opcode that has that as the content. The various PHP commands get translated to various PHP opcodes. When you have an include, this is what someone was asking, we go back, we read in the file that we're including, we parse it to a set of opcodes, we execute those opcodes. And there is no sort of efficiency here at all. So if you include a file multiple times, you're going to have to parse it multiple times. It's not very efficient. That's one of the reasons why I say, well, don't have a footer include. Many people do include header, include footer. What you should be doing, include the header once, and in the header file, have a footer function. When it comes time to doing the footer on the page, just call the footer function instead of doing an include footer. Because it's more efficient to just load in a single file and parsing those and then just calling a function here versus opening up two files and parsing them to a set of opcodes. And never include the same file twice. That doesn't make any sense at all. Right? If there's some stuff in that file that you need to do multiple times, wrap a function around it and call the function. Now, what an opcode cache does, and there are plenty of them around, is it caches this middle layer. It caches the opcodes that are generated by the opcode parser. So this is sort of the logic. The first time it comes in, nothing is cached. We compile the scripts to a set of opcodes. We store those opcodes in shared memory, generally. Then we execute them. And include comes, that same file hasn't been included before. Fine, we compile it to opcodes, store that include file in shared memory, and off we go. Second time through, we see, hey, this file's already been cached. Fetch it, fetch the opcode tree, the function table, the class table, and execute it directly. So we skip this compile to opcode stage. And, sorry? Oh, 30 minutes. Okay, thank you. It's pretty simple, actually. simply caching that middle layer. So you only have to execute, you don't have to parse. Yes. Same way. I mean, the question is, how does it handle conditional includes? This is a runtime thing. I mean, once the include comes, all we're checking the list of files that are in the cache. If the files, and it's actually, different caches do different things. Some do it by full path name, other do it by inode. So when it gets down to the level of the include, we check the inode, we look in our shared memory, is that inode in the cache? Yes, okay, read it, otherwise don't. So the fact that there's a conditional around it doesn't really matter. It won't get cached and it won't get parsed unless that condition is true. So there are a bunch of them out there. The main ones, APC is the one they get via Peckle, it's in pair. IronCube used to be called PHPA, and ZenCache is the commercial one from the Zen guys in Israel. There's also one called Turk MMCache, right? And there's also that other one that I forget what's called. I think there's 7 now on my last count. There's all kinds of ones popping up all the time. They're typically very easy to install. This snuck in here. Yinst is a Yahoo tool. I do these talks for Yahoo engineers as well, and I thought I had cleaned out all the Yahoo content of this particular slide, but obviously I haven't. But yes, typically very easy to install. You grab the shared library, you send extension path to your shared library. That's all you really need to do, restart your web server. So, optimization. Half an hour to go through optimization. Don't optimize unless you have to, right? Wait until you have a problem, then solve the damn problem. Look ahead a little bit, but don't try to solve every problem before you get them, because you'll never finish anything that way. Solve the problem, see where the bottlenecks are, and off you go. Having said that, there are some things up front that you should try to avoid. Look at how many includes you have on any one request. I like to say no more than 5. I know that comes as a shock to some people, but the number here isn't that important. The idea is to be aware of how many includes you have. Just don't keep adding includes to this stuff. We had one site where they had 47 includes, and they were using the include path stuff that where PHP has to go through and check various directories, and the directory where all 47 files were was the 8th directory on their list of include paths. So the number of stat calls on this stuff was just amazing. So think a little bit about how many includes you have and where you put them and how you access them. Don't go overboard on the object orientation. It is an extra layer. PHP is an interpreted language. There is some overhead involved in OO. Any sort of layers has overhead. Anything you do has a cost associated with it. So think about things a little bit. Use an opcode cache. They're very easy to install. They're free. Download them, install them, things will automatically go faster for the most part. Watch your regular expressions. It's very easy to write regular expressions that will really bog down your server. Cache everything. If you have some slow back-end data source that changes once every 10 minutes, well, only access it once every 10 minutes, right? If it's not going to change over that 10-minute period, access it, save it locally, and then wipe that thing out and refresh it every 10 minutes with a cron job or some other mechanism. So think about caching everything. And if you have plenty of CPU overhead, or if plenty of CPU left, then you can turn on output compression. I'll talk about that in a little bit. So keeping those rules in mind, once you've written something, it's a very good idea to figure out how fast it goes. Benchmark the thing. If you're trying to optimize something, first you have to sort of figure out, okay, how fast do I go? And when your boss comes and asks you, how many servers are you going to need to put this thing online? Can we do it with one server? And then your first question has to be, okay, how many requests per second are we expecting? If he says 100 requests per second, which is a lot, actually, but whatever the numbers are, then you have to sit down and benchmark your application and see, how many can I push out? How many servers is this going to take? One thing to check right up front, watch your I/O buffers. Whenever you have to send something out through your network card, it's going to go through your kernel. The kernel has an internal buffer that it buffers stuff and then delivers it. By default, I think it's 65K on Linux. I'm not sure though. You can check yours, but it's very easy to change. You can stick a larger number into proxysnet core wmmax, and in your HTTP script, you can put in send buffer size of 65K. What this means is that the kernel will deliver 65K at a time. So your PHP script can generate 65K of information before the kernel says, stop. Wait, I need to deliver some of this stuff. I don't have more room in my buffer. And then you can do another write to the kernel at that point. Now, if your entire page fits in 65K, you're done. You've delivered it. Even if the client is some guy in China on a 20 baud modem or something, it's going to take them 3 days to download. That's fine. The kernel is going to sit there and it's going to deliver it. It might run out of something, some resources at a certain point, but it's not going to take off an Apache child process for you. And that's the important thing. You want to get rid of the information and get to the next request as fast as possible. Let the kernel level worry about delivering the data. If you're consistently blowing those kernel buffers, then things are going to slow down because you're going to be limited by the speed of the people connecting to your website. And that's a bad limitation to be in because there are a lot of folks on slow connections out there. So have a look at the average content or average page size that you're spewing out and increase your I/O buffers a little bit in your kernel so that most of them will fit. Obviously, you can't fit all of them. If you're serving up download files, 10 gig files or something, or 100 meg files, you cannot make your I/O buffers that big. But if you're close, if you just need to go from 65 to 85, well, increase it to 85 so you can get this stuff out in a single write. That's going to make things go faster. Anyway, once you've checked that your I/O buffers aren't consistently being blown, write some kind of benchmark script that does standard things that your application does. I have kind of a bogus one here that just goes through and does a bunch of PHP stuff. It does some string manipulation, appends to a string, does some array stuff, includes two files, creates some arrays, loops through them, creates an object with a bunch of methods, calls all those methods. So it does a bunch of stuff that a normal PHP application might do. These are the two include files. One has a function in it that does some stuff. The other one just has a bunch of text in it. So that's my benchmark application. This is what I'm going to see. How fast can I make this thing go? I use a tool called HTTP Load. You can get it from acme.com, acme.com. I like it. It's a little threaded loader. You tell it, please give me 5 parallel connections. Each connection do 2,000 requests for a total of 10,000. You can also set a rate limiter and please hit this at 10 requests per second if you wanted to. I tend to just load up, see how many concurrent I want and how many total I want it to do, and off it goes. This came back here. That's pretty hard to read, isn't it? A little bit better. This came back and said 2,500 requests were completed. They had code 200. Check that code. If it says code 404, 2,500, it means you're only benchmarking your 404 error page, which isn't necessarily what you wanted to do. That means you got your URL wrong. HTTP load takes a file. Each line of the file has a URL. So it'll go through and test all of those. In my particular case, I'm just testing one script. So I have one URL in the file that I feed to HTTP load. And the main number here is it's telling me I can do 156 requests per second for this particular application on this particular hardware. And each request was 7848 bytes. And there are some other averages and stuff in here. Another thing that's important, when you're doing load testing like this, have a look at what's happening on the server while you're doing it. Run vmstat1 or something and have a look at the very least at your CPU idle numbers. If you don't see CPU idle of zero or close to zero consistently, that means you're not CPU bound. In this case, I'm CPU bound. There's no idle CPU left over. My CPU is cranking as hard as it can, spitting out as many pages as it can. So in this particular benchmark, I'm actually testing different opcode caches. So here's base PHP, then I added APC, then I added IronCube, well, one at a time, and then MMCache, whatever it's called. And all of them were basically CPU bound, which I was expecting. Now, just to give you an idea of what an I/O bound test would be, I loaded up, I think, a 800K file or something. I hit this 800K file as fast as I possibly could. And then I looked at my VM stat number, and it's telling me I have 74% idle CPU while my test is running. That means I'm I/O bound. That means I cannot speed up this application simply by tweaking my code a little bit and making my code run faster, because what's holding me back is that my network card is not fast enough. I'd probably have to throw a gigabit card in my computer to get away from being I/O bound. So if you're benchmarking, make sure you know that you're CPU bound before you start optimizing your code. Because if you're I/O bound, you're optimizing your code, you're not going to see any effect from these changes. All right, so if you are actually I/O bound, that means you're sending too much stuff through a pipe that's too small. So either send less stuff or get a bigger pipe. One easy way to send less stuff would be to turn on output compression. You have all this spare CPU power hanging around, 74% idle, the CPU is twiddling its thumbs, not doing anything. Make it do something. Make it compress the data before it sends it. There are two main ways of doing it. You can turn it on in PHP INI. We have this automatic GC handler that you can turn on that automatically compresses all the output if the end browser is capable of decompressing it. So it checks the accept headers and stuff to see, do we think the browser can automatically uncompress this stuff? If we think so, we compress it. And you also have an external Apache module called mudgsit that does the same thing for all Apache requests going through that server. This one would only do it for PHP requests, obviously. And that will very nicely chew up all your CPU, because compression is pretty expensive CPU-wise. Now, let's assume we're CPU-bound. What are some of the easy things we can do to speed up our PHP scripts? First of all, check your include path. If you're not doing absolute includes with full paths or relative paths, and you're doing includes like this with just a file name, make sure that file is found in one of the first components of your include path. PHP's include path is sort of like command path, right? It's colon separated list of directories where PHP is going to go through and look for that file in order. So in this case, it's going to look in user share pair first, and then it's going to look in the current directory after. Now, by default, the PHP that comes, I think we by default have the current directory first, because most people are just including a file from the current directory first. That actually means it's one extra stat. If you do have a shared directory somewhere that you're consistently loading stuff from, it's always going to check the current directory, then it's going to go check the shared directory. Stick the shared directory first, and any stuff in the current directory, put a ./ in front of it. Because if it is right there in the current directory, it's going to move around with your other files. As you move all the files around, they're going to move right with them. There's no point in having ./ in the include path, actually. I mean, we have it in there as part of PHP because people would get confused if the include wouldn't work when the file's right there in the current directory. So we put the ./ in there, just like your command path on Linux, right? Typically, you shouldn't put the ./ in it because you don't want hacks like that. You don't want your ls or something to get overridden by some hacker who's put an ls command in your current directory. Now, so this is one quick way of saving a stat system call. It's not going to save you that much, but go through and change all your direct includes to ./, if that's what you're doing, and check your include path. If you're using OpenBaseTheR, if you need it, great. It's very useful. It can solve some problems. If you don't need it, get rid of it. It adds a whole bunch of extra stats to every single file request, and it can slow you down a lot. So if you're really concerned about speed, sorry, no OpenBaseTheR for you. Variables order. This can also speed things up. By default, we have EGPCS, means environment, get, post, cookie, and server variables are automatically populated in PHP. So you have $_server, $_get, $_post. All those variables are populated with the appropriate information. $_env are all the environment variables. If you have a big environment on every single request, we load up this huge environment array. That can take some time. Same with the server variables. Apache sets a whole bunch of them, like 30 of them. On every single request, we're going to have to populate that array. If you never use those variables, if you never use an environment variable, or if you never use an Apache server variable, don't populate those. And even if you do need to use them every now and then, they're both accessible. So if you used to have $_server document root, you can use getenv. Getenv is first going to check the Apache variables and the subprocess environment of Apache. If it doesn't find it there, it's going to drop to the Unix level env. So both S and E, meaning $_server and $_env, are accessible via getenv, with the server ones overriding the system ones. At Yahoo, this is the standard. We don't even populate cookie, actually, because we have our own cookie handling mechanism. So we just have GP. Anything else, we have to go directly via getenv to get stuff. Like I said, adding an opcode cache should be easy. Just turn it on. So the results of these various little hacks on my test benchmark script. You saw my standard one. I could get 156 requests per second from not doing anything, just for the standard install. Once I fixed my include path and only populating G and P, so get and post variables, a little bit of a jump, from 156 to 161. This delta here would depend on how big your environment is. A lot of people start Apache from their own accounts. You tend to have a whole bunch of environment variables in your own accounts. If you do that, every single PHP script is going to slow down because you have a huge environment. You really should start Apache with the supplied startup scripts that cleans the environment first and then launches Apache. Or get rid of E from the variables order. Now, adding the various accelerators, adding IronCube on top got me up to 191. Adding APC with the optimizer turned on, this is APC2 actually, and using IPC shared memory and semaphore locking got me up to 196. Turk mmcache with no optimizer and using spin locks got me to 198. Then I hacked up APC because I was annoyed that Turk was the fastest. Since APC is part of PHP, basically that's sort of the default optimizer, or default opcode cache. I added mmap and user space sleep locks to APC, and that got us up to 200 requests per second. Then Turk has this optimizer you can turn on that takes it up to 202. The problem with that optimizer in Turk is it doesn't always work. And it's one of these things, yeah, you can go really fast, but only sort of 99% accurate. That's not very good. So to me, still, APC2 is the fastest and most robust opcode, a free opcode cache out there anyway. At Yahoo, I've actually hacked it somewhat further. I've killed a lot of system calls in PHP that we sort of need, but at Yahoo, we just can't afford to do it. So I'm actually up to about 270 on this particular benchmark on the Apache version or the Yahoo version of PHP. But that Yahoo version of PHP, a lot of things that a normal PHP user would assume just doesn't work. Require once is broken, all kinds of stuff is broken there, and I've just, because it's a smaller community, I can say, you must do things this way. You must program this way. You cannot use this set of features because I've killed them, because we need extra speed. So it's sort of a very, I don't know, stripped down, castrated version of PHP that we're running at Yahoo. It's fast, but yeah, it's weird. So, but still, 200 requests per second for a script that does quite a bit, and this was benchmarked on my laptop here. I mean, this is not a very fast server by any stretch of the imagination, but multiply 200 times, what is it, 86,400, that's how many requests per day that this thing can spit up. That's a hell of a lot. That's more than most websites will ever need. Even without doing anything, 156 is a lot of pages that can be served up. All right. If you really do need more speed out of this thing, if you need to go faster than 200 on my little benchmark here, have a look at what's happening. Look at your code. And I don't mean look at it manually yourself, because you wrote it. You made the mistakes. You're not going to find the mistakes. Right? You need someone about twice as smart to find your mistakes in your own code. So what you need is a tool. There are a couple of them out there. One of them is called APD. You can just do pair install APD. It'll download it, compile it, and make it all work. Make sure it's turned on in your PHP ini file. Point it to apd.so. Set a dump directory, apd dumpdir /temp. Then in the script that you want to profile, you can add in this apd set pprof trace. That turns on profiling for the script. So anything that happens after this call will get added to the profiling stats. Then we have this pprofp command line tool that reads these files. And it has a bunch of options on them. Don't worry about reading that. You pass it one of these temporary files. So pprofp, the temporary file, and you're going to get output like this. I know it's really small, but what it says along here is percentage of the time, real accumulated, user system, seconds per call, the number of calls, cumulative seconds per call, memory and memory usage, and the name of the actual thing that was accessed. This is either a function or a class method or a built-in PHP function. So for my little test stuff, there's really not much to see because it executes so fast, 200 times a second. I mean, it executes fast. All I can really tell from this is this function was called 200 times, this function string to operator 26 times, substring was called 52 times. So it's a little bit of a sanity check. You can go through and does it make sense that I call this particular function 200 times, or can I cache the result and just call that function once? For something a little bit more complex, I profiled the PHP website, the main top level of the PHP website, and what trickles to the top here is require once. 33% of the time was spent inside require once. And that does make sense, because require once and require and include, the time that gets associated with those is the time it takes to execute all the code underneath it. So all the code that it executes before it comes back out of that include gets associated with that include. So if you're seeing require and include trickle to the top, you're probably okay. That's to be expected. What you need to look out for are the things that come up that aren't includes. Here's one, FEOF. Called 183 times, and it took 22% of my time. So I'm probably reading a file line by line and testing for FEOF at the end of every line. I would probably be better off to load in the entire file in one go. It would use a bit more memory, but I would suck it all into memory once, and I would exchange memory for performance in this particular case. And this is what the profiler can tell me very fast. And there's also some other ones in here. You see some negative memory usage. This is because of the way PHP does garbage collection, and you can actually end up calling something that then dereferences a bunch of stuff, so by the time you get back out of that call, you're using less memory overall. And this profiler basically says, well, this function took negative 3K to execute because it freed up a bunch of stuff. So it's not super reliable looking at this memory usage stuff. It can trick you quite a bit, but it does give you an indication of where the memory is being used. There's also another profiler called XDebug. I don't have time to go through XDebug as well, but there's a whole documentation online on xdebug.org about using it to do profiling. Now, XDebug does stuff other than just profiling. So if you're going through your profiling, you're trying to figure out stuff, you're trying to figure out why stuff is so slow. You can also get stack traces. You can try to figure out, hey, why is this function being called? How is it being called? And you can put this xdebug stack start trace in there. And then at any point, you can do an xdebug dump function trace. And the output looks something like this. Of course, it's not very interesting in my very simple little script here, but basically it just says that I have function A that calls function B, and I have function B that dumps the trace, right? So when I call A, it then calls into B, and at this point, I see the call trace going, hey, this went into A, then it went into B. For something this simple, it doesn't help much, but if you have a lot of files, a lot of include files, a lot of functions calling something else, it's sometimes interesting to be able to trace backwards from line numbers going, okay, this is how we got to this point, this is why we were called in this particular instance. There's also a modified error handler that you've seen a couple of times today. The standard PHP error handler doesn't actually look like this. It's sort of very ugly, just a single string. This modified one adds a call trace to it. So here I'm accessing a variable that doesn't exist. So I get this undefined variable A in my script. And because this is running as part of my presentation, it's an eval inside a bunch of other presentation code, you sort of see the whole trace of how I got there. Main, display, presentation, example display, because I'm inside an example. I'm in this example method, and I'm doing an eval, because I'm actually doing eval of this PHP code to display the result. This threw an error, showed me the error, and gave me the whole college trace of how I got there. You can do this without Xdebug. We do have a call trace function in PHP itself, so you could actually do this itself. This is one, just one of the added features that Xdebug gives you once you install it and enable it. There's also a modified var dump. It's a bit silly, but I mean, it does color syntax highlighting of var dump, and it makes sure that it looks nice in HTML and stuff. Not super useful, but so that, those are some of the other things that it does other than the profiling. It also gives you a server thing. It's sort of hard to explain, but you turn on this server debugger. Whenever you then access a page on your web server, you can start up a client, and there's a thing called debug client, which is a sample client that speaks this protocol. You can then put a breakpoint on any function. It's very GDB-like in a sense. So you can put a breakpoint anywhere on the function in your website. When the flow gets to that function, you get, just like in GDB, you get a break, and you can then start looking at variables. You can change the value of variables, and you can then continue on, let it run to the next breakpoint. So you can sort of, without putting in a bunch of printfs or a bunch of echoes all the way throughout your PHP code, you can use breakpoints, and you can use this GDB-like tool from the outside to debug your script. Don't have time to show you that. I was going to, but I'm running out of time. Once you've all done all that, stop. You've tuned it, you've profiled it, you have optimized some of the code that you saw trickle to the top of your profiling list. You've configured your web server correctly, you checked your I/O buffers. You've done all these steps along the way. Anything beyond that, it's probably not worth it. It can take you a month to find some little tiny incremental thing that you can do. It tends not to be worth it. Throw another server at it. A month of engineering time versus the cost of one more web server is no context. Right? So at a certain point, you just have to say, this is how fast it is. And this is one of the hardest things. It's kind of a funny slide, I guess, that I mean, stop. It's a strange concept to a lot of developers. Nothing is ever done. Right? Your code is never, ever done. There's always some little thing you can tweak. And it's the single biggest thing that's stopping us from getting stuff done is that you sit around and fiddle with this crap forever. You just have to say, no, it's done. This is how fast it is. This is what it does. Ship it. Right? And I've had a lot of developers that really can't do that. I keep asking, so are you done? Like, no, I need to tweak this. I need to tweak that. I can do this part better. Stop. I have 8 other problems for you to work on. Stop. Next problem. This is how fast it is. Great. So, and go home, visit your kids. This is my son hacking away on PHP 6 at home. And I have like 2 minutes left for questions. Resources, online, all these guys, Bugs, Pear, Peckle, XDebug. 2 minutes for questions, yeah.